Hello and welcome to the Texas Tribune Tribcast for the third week of June 2010. I'm reporter Elise Hugh, along with Ben Philpott from KUT and the Tribune.
Hello.
And two substitute podcasters today. We have Reeve Hamilton, reporter of the Tribune.
Hello.
And Jim Henson, who is one of our pollsters.
Hi, Hello.
Jim. Today we are talking the GOP convention of last weekend, Hispanics and the issue of immigration here in Texas, White and Perry and their summer-long back and forth, and finally, the resurrection of the Big 12 conference. We'll start with Ben.
Well, so the GOP conference is called the largest, what is it, the largest political gathering in the world, I believe that's what they say.
It's called that because it is.
Right? Well, yes. But I mean, well, I think there are some political gatherings in India that sometimes battle for the title. But anyway, it was a good event, I guess, as far as party battles went. In 2008, during the convention, there were a lot of problems, issues, touchy-feely things going on with Ron Paul supporters who really felt like their guy should have been given more time at the convention. He was a much more serious presidential candidate than people thought he would be, and he was pushed to the side, not allowed to talk to the people at the convention. This time, you kind of had the same thing going with Deborah Medina, who made a run for the Republican nomination for governor. She was pushed to the side, not allowed in because of a lawsuit that she had against the state party. But it didn't seem like it was that big of a. I mean, people were disappointed by it; they were upset by it. Several people went to hear her speak on an offsite event.
She had her own sort of simultaneous convention down the street.
Right. And you know, it was attended pretty well considering, you know, there were some big speakers talking at the main Republican convention at the same time she was talking. But, you know, I think the difference this year was in 2008, the Ron Paul people were sitting there yelling and banging their heads against the wall, which the wall being the established party mechanisms. This session, you had Ron Paul people, Tea Party supporters there, and they weren't just banging their heads against the wall. They were actually getting elected to positions within the party apparatus. So they were disappointed that some of their ideas were pushed to the side a little, but at the same time, they're putting themselves in a better position to make sure those ideas are included in the next convention in 2012. You had Don Zimmerman, who, for anyone here in Austin, knows he's a big anti-tax Ron Paul Republican leader here. He ran for state rep in Mark Strama's district in 2006, was called not a real Republican, was beaten by an, quote, establishment Republican candidate, and then he got elected to the state executive committee during this convention. So from 4 years, he went from a political outsider to a party outsider to a party insider, and now he'll be there to try and help set, you know, the next agendas for the next few sessions, and Munisteri as well, the new chair of the GOP party.
You know, that outsider-insider thing is interesting. I mean, I'm wondering if you talk to some of these Tea Party folks that got elected in, because to me it's a fascinating question, is are these people really new? You know, those conventions, I went in 2002, 2004, and I think in 2006, and those conventions are always just a hornet's nest of internal fighting, the anti-Rhino forces. And I'm wondering how many of these folks we're thinking of as Tea Partiers have been there for a while and are just sort of seizing the moment.
Well, Don Zimmerman was telling me that there was a pretty good crowd of Tea Party folks there. And it was easy for, not that any of the libertarian kind of sided people were trying to manipulate those new people, but I mean, when you're new, you're there, you don't know exactly what's going on. You're trying to understand everything that's going on around you. And one of the things they understood, or we assume they understood, is there was a battle for chair of the Republican Party against an establishment person. Tea Party people are anti-incumbent. An establishment person who may have not use the party money the right way, and then an anti-establishment person who is ready to come in and be this big reformer. Well, you know, Tea Party people probably helped him win the election.
Yeah, the reformers of today become the establishment of tomorrow.
Right.
So I feel like, I mean, if this is the sentiment, if the anti-incumbent sentiment is going to be so strong, are we essentially, or are parties essentially going to have to just keep purging the people who are getting their foot in the door and getting some experience just as they're becoming good at their jobs?
Well, I just think it'll be interesting to see how much, you know, so they have their foot in the door now. So how much are they willing to sit back and chill and continue to get their foot further in the door instead of, you know, now that the foot's in the door, come in, you know, with both barrels loaded and go crazy when in one of the executive committee meetings. I mean, yeah. Not actually shoot anyone, but just, you know.
Yeah, you got to be careful.
Yeah, you know, hey,
we are in Texas.
I'm all of a sudden here, you know, do exactly what I want. Well, that doesn't work. And actually, somebody was explaining to me that this is pretty much how the conservative Christians ended up all of a sudden taking over the National Republican Party, is that they, instead of just banging their heads against the wall, went to the meetings, got elected to leadership positions, and then all of a sudden the
worked
National
within the institution,
and all of a sudden the National Republican Party looks around and sees that there's a majority. There's nothing they can do.
Well, and I think a little perspective on this too. I mean, you know, it's one thing to stand up and go, "We hate incumbents. We're anti-incumbent." If you're a Republican, the incumbents are all your guys.
Right.
Well,
right.
Did they know when they elected Ministeri that he was going to be charging them for membership, which he says is going to be one of his first things to make up for the debt?
Yeah, I don't think that was in his platform speech.
Speaking of the platform, this is actually a good time to kind of seg over to Jim's topic, because the platform is very aggressively anti-Hispanic immigrant or Mexican-American immigrant. And yet the party at the same time is doing a lot of Spanish language outreach.
Right.
And so I'm wondering kind of, is this a two-headed monster going in two different directions?
Well, I mean, I think, you know, that's a real interesting thing in all the polling we've done. I mean, we had a battery of immigration items last time. And, you know, the Republican numbers on, you know, what would be called basically, you know, they wouldn't call it this, but basically anti-immigrant positions are just through the roof, right? And so if you look at most important issue, you know, it scored higher than it had for a while statewide. But this was like, you know, the Republican numbers are just you know, astronomical. You know, we tested something like that was, you know, based on the Arizona ID law, the show your papers kind of provision, and we got, you know, over 80% support for that among Republicans. So you do, I think it's, you know, the two-headed beast. I mean, maybe what you get is this disjuncture between leadership and what's out there in the rank and file, that when you go and you talk public opinion with folks, you know, and you push that button, there's a lot of anti-immigrant sentiment out there among the shock troops of the Republican Party who are not thinking really on the same kind of, you know, plane that the party strategists, that the business interests in the party are. And so I think that's what's really interesting here, is that you've got this disjuncture between the leadership and the rank and file, in which the leadership, by their nature, some of them at least are thinking about the future and thinking about the demographics that, you know, everyone is talking to death, where the rank and file really are responding to much more proximate kind of sentiment.
It sounds like they still have a little bit more time, though, because it feels like we've been talking about this big sleeping giant of Hispanic voters waking up for the last decade at least. And still, you know, they're not showing up at polls in very high numbers, and largely because of what education status
all the determinants of voting in the Hispanic population keep turnout down, and it, you know, and you annoy Democrats and you say that, but I mean, you sit there and when you, you know, talk about this, let's go to the Democratic side for a second and say, you know, the Hispanic vote is not going to save you, at least it's not going to save anybody in this room anyway.
So does it matter then that this anti-immigrant sentiment is so strong?
Well, you know, I think it matters in the sense that, you know, it gives you something it's like a hook, if you will, for Republican voters. Now, you have to be very careful in the way you talk about it, but it's the kind of thing you talk about during an election and then don't follow up on, frankly.
Well, I mean, it's also, it might be important that it's so strong for non-electoral reasons, too. I mean, you know, you have, like, there was that video that came out of the convention of people saying, "Oh, I think the immigrants are stealing from me. We need laser beams to keep them out." I mean, just from a, you know, an interpersonal, like, let's get along in the state kind of situation, it seems there's some pretty dramatic feelings.
Yeah, I think if you back off of it in that way, yeah, certainly as a cultural phenomenon, it's really important in the state. You know, it's a big contradiction out there. I mean, I think, again, looking at some of the polling data, people, you know, you get this expression that people are used to having immigrants around them in their daily life, right? And so on a day-to-day basis, I don't think you've got a bunch of people walking around thinking, "Oh, you know, I hate these people."
When does being anti-immigrant turn into racism? I mean, it's a fine line.
Well, I just think it'll be interesting to see which way the party goes in terms of, you know, the platform has always been tougher than what you've seen the elected Republicans end up doing. I mean, I think you could make an argument that Governor Perry hasn't done enough for the platform view of what immigration should be. And that's because of business interests and, you know, more moderate feelings, you know, the higher up you go in office and all this. But, you know, it'll be interesting to see at some of the state house levels how this translates in future elections. You know, had Bert Solomons, Republican representative from Carrollton, almost get or have a tough race in his primary based on the idea that, you know, he was the one blocking immigration bills from going through the state affairs committee, which he chairs.
Right. Yeah. And people acting like Todd Smith is some kind of radical because he was a moderate on voter ID.
Right. And so exactly. So will you see, you know, will immigration continue to be something that will at some point make those elected in some of these, especially the more suburban rural areas, more dramatically right on that issue?
So, yeah, I mean, yeah, go ahead. Well, I mean, I agree with your point in a lot of ways that, you know, there's a bigger kind of cultural thing here. At the electoral kind of institutional level, it's like this constant irritant in the system for, you know, for the process in a lot of ways.
Right. So, I mean, I guess maybe the extent that it matters is sort of tied to this insider-outsider thing and who sort of ends up winning that. I mean, you know, speaking of leadership, one of the big... I mean, maybe it wasn't big because I wasn't there, but, you know, the push that you got the most news about was this sort of push to commit to getting rid of the House Speaker, Joe Strauss, right. Who's perceived as a more moderate guy. And it's hard to imagine him making, you know, harsh anti-immigration laws the number one priority next session. You know, they didn't end up adopting
that. They tried. But you know, again, it's the definitions that you're getting at the convention versus the definitions that happen out in the real world. I mean, in that resolution to get rid of Speaker Strauss, which, you know, non-binding, just something they wanted to throw up there. But in that resolution, it talked about how he was fundraising for Liberal Democrat Patrick Rose. And I don't think there are a whole lot of Democrats that will admit that.
Or consider Patrick Rose
a Liberal Democrat.
Right. Just one quick note on this, too, is Governor Perry's positions, because he's actually been supportive. In fact, in the Bilo debate during the primary, was supportive of continuing to allow financial aid to go to illegal or children of illegal immigrants. And the platform is actually calling for something right. way stricter, saying that they want to deny citizenship to those or limit it to only those born to U.S. citizens.
And you know, you've actually seen, and in the primary, and now continuing even out of the primary, I thought it was interesting, he's actually taken a harder stance than he has in recent years, which is, you know, we're going to pass something that will fine businesses that hire undocumented workers. And that's a stance that he has not taken in the past.
And it's very unpopular with his business constituents.
And, you know, I guess it wasn't necessarily a surprise that he brought it up during the primary, but the idea that now it's past the primary and he's, you know, in a recent speech, I think maybe on the convention floor, he said again. Of course, then he's talking to preaching to the choir there. But so we'll see how much further he takes it.
Well, and I think it's no accident that, you know, when this stuff comes up, you know, he shifts the tone. I mean, you basically recalibrate how you talk about this. It immediately becomes a border security, a failure of the federal government. And I think he touches on those things, but then...
And that's strong message to sell.
Exactly.
Right.
And then finds a very different deflection point to talk about the topic, you know, at all, right. if he has to talk about it in any sustained way.
One business that I think it'll really help is the T-shirt business, because it seemed that the best-selling T-shirt at the convention was one supporting the Arizona law,
right.
which Perry has said he doesn't think is right for Texas.
Another point about Perry's positions not being in line. But while we're on Perry, too, I attended a very interesting Team Perry press conference on Tuesday. It was actually scheduled to be right in front of Bill White's Austin headquarters, which was a fairly interesting place to hold a press conference, because by the time Mark Minor, spokesperson for Perry, showed up, White had gathered, or Team White had gathered, you know, dozens of teenagers and college students and other assorted volunteers. They were all armed with signs.
And apparently the San Diego Chicken, I think, was there.
And I don't know how they procured a chicken costume so fast, but a chicken, you know, wearing the name tag, I'm Rick Perry, they were trying to goad Minor as he was giving this press conference.
So you're assuming that they got the chicken suit after they heard about the press conference?
Or it's just been around, I suppose. I don't know why you would procure a chicken suit in advance, but...
I don't know. I think that, you know, one of the things that I thought that was so interesting about this is it's almost the first time that we've seen the Bill White campaign outmaneuver the Rick Perry campaign. And I'm not saying that the white campaign hasn't done a good job on issues, but in terms of kind of the sneakier, sneaky may not be the right word, but in terms of the dirtier elements of this political back and forth, you know, Mark Minor's been hammering white, and White's campaign has had almost no responses, and then all of a sudden you have this one thing, and it's
right. And let me just finish setting it up for folks who weren't there.
Sorry,
we are so far.
It was amazing.
So as soon as you bring up a chicken soup, people right, just get all.
We always the wheels come off when the chicken soup gets brought up. But essentially, Minor was marking 100 days of White not releasing his tax returns. He has now released them back to 04, but
which he did before the 100 days.
Right before the 100 days, but Team Perry is calling for more tax returns, actually dating back to the time he was Democratic 12. Party chair. Democratic Party chair and energy deputy energy secretary. White's folks are saying that this is just another game in which the Perry folks are trying to elude debating.
Saying, I think this was, you know, day, white, day 50 or, of right, Perry being
Perry
chicken
not debating.
About
so
the
right,
debate.
They're calling him Rick Chicken Perry, chanting that over Minor as Minor was trying to
But I thought what
talk.
They were, what they were, Minor was really talking about was when he released his tax returns from 2004 on, the story came out that he has made money off of a company that they used for
Hurricane Rita.
Post-Hurricane Rita.
Right, so they came out to present this turbine.
Right.
Or generator, sorry, not a wind. It'd be a little hard to roll in a wind turbine. But
right, but I mean, so they say that he was profiteering off this disaster, and he says, well, you know, my investment came long after that. Or
right, and so this back and forth is going on, and the Perry team is trying to show off this generator, the symbolic generator. They basically get shouted down. I mean, they are outnumbered by these white volunteers. Everybody's out in the street. You know, we can't shoot a shot of video without having signs in the background, people trying to chant over us too. So it was really chaotic outside.
And the generator looked so small in relation to just
the chicken.
Right. It's a small relation to the chicken. Yeah.
No, and so I guess my question is this an outmaneuvering by the white folks, as Ben describes it, or does it actually kind of make them look silly and make Minor a sympathetic figure?
Because that's was one of your takeaways from the video.
Right, because right? I kind of felt bad for Minor getting yelled over like that, well, shouted down like that.
The thing is that I don't know if it's outmaneuvering. It's them finally sort of like playing defense and saying, we can only
playing
take
offense.
So. Well,
I think they're playing offense.
They're,
on this.
But they're playing. It's on their headquarters. It's on literally their land. Right. That Mark Minor is coming in and invading, and they're saying, "Well, wait, we'll take all the other stuff, but you cannot get away with this."
Well, but I think the thing is though that, and I'm not saying this is what the Perry campaign was thinking, but in terms of fighting back, there's been so little on the white side that maybe they just assumed, you know what, we can probably show up in front of their headquarters and they won't do a dang thing.
I'm still being stunned by the fact that at least you feel sorry for Mark Minor, but I guess I'll get beyond that. You know, but I mean, I think the issue, I mean, to me, the issue is if you step back from this, I mean, there's this tactical sort of maneuvering that we're talking about. And, you know, at the end of the day, I mean, is this going to change the trajectory of things at all? I suspect not. It's early and we watch it. And it gets some coverage. I mean, in a way, I mean, if you really want to do a little bit of tactical analysis, I guess, in the absence of the chicken and the shouting, how much coverage does this stunt get? I think ultimately the Perry campaign got more coverage of this event. It wasn't what they wanted necessarily, but...
But the message that is out of it is, you know, white people crash Perry's party, not whatever their message was about the VTech.
Not, you know, we already know. We know he did one thing that we're calling dirty from the small amount of tax returns he returned. Just think how many more dirty things he's done if we just knew what he did.
And honestly, it's the first time that I really think, aside from maybe that cartoon web video they put out a few weeks ago, which is sort of a minor, even more minor event than this, I think it's the first time we've really seen the white campaign having a good time.
And doing something.
Yeah. That's right.
And doing something creative.
Yeah. So, I mean, that, if that is
so maybe they just need to lighten up a little.
But at least it's a change that might get more people interested.
Yeah. Somehow, in retrospect, it's going to be weird if we have to look back and say, what, and then it all changed the day of the chicken.
Yeah. That was, yeah. You
know, it was that chicken.
We're sitting here in November saying, you know what? After the chicken, the numbers just flipped. You know?
Something tells me that is not the case.
Well, and that's the other issue here is, I mean, I think, you know, reporters. And, you know, I've been reading, there's a blog called The Monkey Cage that a former colleague of mine does that's sort of about political science and politics and the difference between media and following these things at the higher level. I mean, we're at the point now where we're desperate for narrative. Right. And we're desperate for events. You know, it's mid-June. It's going to be a long, hot summer of, you know, in a lot of ways, frankly, kind of crap like this. And the question is it going to change?
That's the buzzword for the podcast.
Is it going to change the narrative? Are we seeing anything that's changing the fundamentals? Right. And I'm not seeing it. And, right. You know, and the Democrats, of course, are going to hang on this. And that's what they're trying to do. They need to push the Perry campaign off of the position they're in. And maybe so I'm watching too much basketball. But.
Well, I think at the next event, they're going to light the chicken on fire and have him jump through a hoop or something.
To Mark Miner's credit, I don't know if the scene made him look sympathetic, but you cannot get that guy off message. I mean, there's
he's
a whole
so good.
Thing going
yeah.
on around him, and he's just like, well, we're here to do this BTEC
right.
presentation.
And the video actually doesn't do him justice because we were able to crank up his mic so that you could actually hear him. But had we not manipulated the video, you could really see how talented he is because it was so loud that there was no way he could have heard himself. But he was very coherent, very good. And so, you know, applaud him for that. With our remaining few minutes, Reeve, real quick, the Big 12 is saved as a 10-member conference. Yay.
Right. Well, earlier you called it the resurrection. I don't know. Non-death, I think, you know, is not the same as a resurrection. Basically, everyone knows this by now. There was this big worry that all the Texas teams in the Big 12 were going to get scattered around the country into different conferences. They ultimately decided the 10 remaining teams that are in the Big 12 will stay together. So it's the Big 12 minus Nebraska and Colorado. You know, they'll probably need to come up with a new name. At a press conference on Tuesday, UT president Bill Powers offered up the conference formerly known as the Big 12.
It'll just be a symbol.
Yeah.
The Big 12 light.
Yeah, we are proposing a design contest for whoever can come up with the most creative symbol to take right. the place of their name. Anyway, there was supposed to be a big, before they announced this decision, there was going to be a big higher ed hearing about it over the legislature. That ended up getting canceled because there's really nothing they can do. The thing is that there was really nothing they could do all along. It was going to be purely sort of come in, tell us what you're thinking. We really can't take any action on this. Unless you are Garnet Coleman from Houston. I mean, he couldn't take action this time, but he really wants University of Houston, which is the school by his house, to be in the Big 12. There are a lot of schools that got
Texas
left
Christian.
Behind when the Southwest Conference dissolved that would like to get catch back up, I guess. And he told me that he was willing to do some legislative law changes to make this possible in the future to get these schools in there. Chances of that happening, I assume, are pretty low. But you know, someone out there is talking about seeing what they can do legislatively to help these schools that are not in the new Big 10, 12 conference.
Well, you know, I've heard some people kind of bring it back to the idea of tuition deregulation and the state legislature giving less and less money to the state universities. So what do they go out and do? They try to find more and more money through these conference payouts. Now, obviously, the vast majority of that goes back into the athletic programs, but some of it trickles down into the gigantic budgets of these state institutions. And so they're at least, you know, using that. Whether or not that's a good argument to make, I heard that come up a couple of times with this.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, whenever you start talking about football, and being somebody from the academic side, I walk very carefully here, but...
yes, you don't want to get fired.
You know,
Professor Henson of the University of Texas at Austin.
Well, I mean, I think it's...
You mean walk very carefully and you don't want to overstate your
right,
life for football.
Exactly. It's hard not to watch this with a certain degree of chagrin. I mean, you know, we've been talking about, you bring up the, you know, tuition deregulation. I mean, you know, higher education in the state is in a transitional period that really has to be described as something of a crisis. It was really hard to deal with the issue last time. You know, the talk of the statewide budget cuts are rippling through higher education, and yet, you know, all of a sudden everything kind of ground to a halt. Everybody, the legislature, the business community, the administration of the university is all of a sudden super responsive to the dissolution of the Big 12, possibly. It's it's a little rough to watch in some ways.
They weren't worried about the science department not getting reaccredited. It was, you know, it was whether or not the Big 12 would
right. And look, you know, I mean, we're all realistic here. And to be fair, look, football. If you talk to the development and the fundraising people at UT, the success of the football team and the success of athletics does help the university raise money in other fronts. I mean, there's a certain
mind share.
Yeah, exactly, and that's helpful. And so, you know, I mean, it's important, and it's not like they could ignore it. But, you know, there's big issues out there right now for higher ed that we're having trouble grappling with.
And I think that's really why people like, you know, Coleman want U of H to get in this, so that it raises the profile of their sports teams, which are actually pretty successful, and that
raises their money and
that helps them. And basically what I heard it compared to a lot is Tier 1, which is, you know, another situation where the legislature actually can't make a school Tier 1, just like they can't tell them to join a conference, but they can hold hearings and they can say, well, you know, we want you to do whatever is best for you. And then we don't exactly know how to make those improvements. And they just sort of have to watch.
You bring up Houston. I think the regional politics, I mean, like, one to kind of bring it back to politics a little bit more, the regional politics of this were really fascinating in terms of the increasing, you know, metropolitan urbanization of Texas, and the fact that the people that were really just, you know, looking to be the big losers in this were Baylor. I mean, Waco was just completely
and
up
Texas
in arms.
Tech.
Yeah, and Tech.
I mean, there were some plans that would have Tech not joining Texas and Texas A&M and Oklahoma State in a move, and so, you know, and Tech and Baylor were, of course, just about to kill themselves over that idea.
Yeah, Waco was really up in arms. Waco. Right.
Well, and they had Ray Perryman, a economist for the state, a state economist, excuse me, had something that Baylor would, or Waco would lose over $100 million a year in revenue.
Just that's all.
Well. Per year, every year, that they're not in the Big 12, and they're playing Conference USA teams.
That's just Reeve being sarcastic.
Oh, yes, sorry.
For those of you who aren't familiar.
That is a lot of
You didn't hold up your sign.
Thank you to Jim Henson for visiting us from the world of academia. It's actually made for a wonkier podcast. And thank you to Ben and Reeve on behalf of all of us.
I tried to keep the wonk out of it.
Right. Good job, everyone. On behalf of everyone, I'm Elise. Thank you for listening.